The following podcast contains strong language and adult themes and is intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Heinke Digital presents. Damocles, an audiobook podcast by Christian Heinke. Chapter 3. The sword. The city bus ride took us west along the A40 highway, once known as the Creep. Now the motorway was a sluggish river consisting almost entirely of thousands of automated vehicles. Sitting on the six-seater city bus, I felt as if I were a blood cell being flushed into a large artery. My vehicle weaved between two large trucks which glided along like rolling skyscrapers without their driver's cabs. The speed on the highway was a steady 100 kilometers, which averaged out faster than the earlier stop and go. Sam sat at one window, watching the passing Ruhr landscape with her usual interest. The A40 highway cut through the city of Essen right down the middle, dividing the city into a poor area in the north and a rich area in the south. No change occurred in the past decades. Emanuel Goldschmidt's villa was in the Kettwig district of Essen. The property was on a hillside with a beautiful view of the valley of the Ruhr River. The villa was a large flat building. I could see the blue lights of the drone copters in front of the house from afar as the city bus turned into the quiet residential street. City bus stopped due to street closure. Sam and I got out of the bus and the city bus drove off again, already on its way to the next customer. I lingered on the opposite curb. Obviously, there had been some sort of incident at the Goldschmidt mansion. "Can you find out what happened?" I whispered to Madeline. 2 hours ago, the housekeeper found Vanessa Goldschmidt floating dead in the home's in-ground pool. "What is the presumed cause of death?" "Chief Superintendent Hubert Siska, the investigator, suspects that Mrs. Goldschmidt fell into the pool, struck her head, and drowned." "Bullshit." "Are you disagree with Chief Inspector Siska's analysis?" she asked. "Sounds too easy, far too smooth. How likely is it that a married couple will die in tragic accidents in different places within 12 hours by sheer chance? For these two particular individuals, the probability of death by accident is 735 to 1. That doesn't sound likely." "That's correct, Joseph." "Any records from the pool area?" I asked. "Wealthy homes usually had extensive video surveillance." "There are recordings," Madeline replied. "Would you like to see them?" "Yes, please." The street in Essen-Kettwig had disappeared around me. Instead, I was standing in a covered swimming pool. The morning sun shone through the glass front, revealing a view of the well-tended garden with trimmed English lawns. I could only assume that I was amid recording the alleged murder of Emanuel Goldschmidt's wife. This streaming technology was madness, I thought. It felt like being transported onto the holodeck of the classic series Star Trek: The Next Generation. It seemed like I was standing at the edge of the pool myself. The door of the wet room area opened and the former Mrs. Goldschmidt stepped out of the glass door. She was wearing a white terry cloth bathrobe. She walked towards the pool. I noticed a whirring sound. A disc-shaped cleaning robot was moving along the edge of the pool. It would cross Mrs. Goldschmidt's path in a few seconds. Aha, I thought. It is possible that in the end it was simply an accident. She would trip over the cleaning robot, hit her head on the edge of the pool, and drown because of losing consciousness. But it turned out differently. Mrs. Goldschmidt saw the cleaning robot. She even greeted him. "Morning," she said.
"Morning, Mrs. Goldschmidt,"
the cleaning robot replied. Mrs. Goldschmidt took off her dressing gown. Underneath, she was naked. She had a slim figure, smooth skin. Mrs. Goldschmidt devoted significant attention to her appearance. She folded the robe. She threw it on a wicker chair at the edge of the pool. Then she paused and stared at something in front of her. She opened her mouth to say something. Then an invisible force threw her head back. A gash on her head spurted blood. Mrs. Goldschmidt let out a guttural cry. She staggered. Her eyes twisted. Unconsciously, she fell into the pool. My first impulse was to jump into the water to help her. Then I remembered I was only watching the agony of someone who had already died. "Go back to where her head flew back, then stop," I ordered Madeline. The scene flashed back before my eyes. Then Mrs. Goldschmidt was once again standing naked at the edge of the pool. Her head flew back. Immediately, blood spurted from a cut on the top of her head. The image froze. I could see the tiny drops in the fine fog of blood. Mrs. Goldschmidt's face contorted in surprise and pain. "Move closer, please." In an instant, I was very close to her head, which was now the head of a giantess. It was clear that her head had been forcefully struck. As the blood spurted out, I could see something sticking out, as if something invisible was standing in her way. "Is there any sign in the surveillance video that someone is beating her? Has someone somehow extracted the perpetrator from the recording data, or have they made him unrecognizable?" I asked. "It appears so. Can we recover the data if we can identify the person?" "Unfortunately, no. Undoing the complete manipulation of the record is not possible. This suggests a very savvy perpetrator with extensive hardware and software knowledge." "Hmm," I said aloud. "At which company did Emmanuel Goldschmidt work as a software engineer?" "The company is called Data Visuals. It produces software and hardware for surveillance systems used by both government and private institutions." "You're kidding me, right?" "Not at all, Joseph. A software engineer and his wife die in two alleged accidents. In both cases, someone erased the alleged killer from the data. The software engineer works for the company responsible for preventing this. The world imposed severe penalties after recent minor wars escalated because of digital manipulation." Another matter required attention. The face of Mrs. Goldschmidt seemed familiar. In the freeze frame, the blow had distorted her face, and she was not wearing any makeup. Dark circles were visible under her eyes, and her eyelids appeared swollen, suggesting she had been crying a lot. But I still recognized the face. "Madeline? Madeline, can you hear me? I know this woman. Can you tell me anything about her?" The scenery of the swimming pool disappeared before Madeline could answer, and I was back on the sidewalk. Hubert Siska was standing in front of me. "What the hell are you doing at one of my crime scenes again, Lenka?" he asked. "That's a very good question," I thought. "Tell him you just were passing by here." "He'll never buy that." "Trust me, Joseph, just tell him what I tell you. I was just passing by." "And I'm supposed to believe that, Lenka?" "Say this. I'm here for my dog. My vet has her practice down the street." "I'm here for my dog," I explained to Siska in a chatty tone. "My vet has her practice at the end of the street. You take your dog all the way to Essen for a vet, and then in this area of fat cats?" "Please answer with exactly." "Exactly." Siska grinned. He had me. I didn't even know a vet had his practice at the end of this street until a few moments ago, let alone had I ever visited this vet with Sam. "Please, trust me, Joseph." I could see Siska checking the vet's database using his implant. He would, of course, know that I had never been there before. That was it. I opened my mouth to say something, but Siska beat me to it. The confident expression on his face gave way to a confused and frustrated grimace. "Seems to be true. You meet in 10 minutes. According to the vet's database, you've been going to the practice for the last 3 years because she specializes in treating big dogs like your German Shepherd." "That's right," I said to Siska. "What did you think?" "Thank you very much, Madeline," I thanked the assistant in my head. "You're welcome, Joseph." I gestured towards the villa with a nod of my head. "What's going on in there, pal?" "None of your business, old man. Go on, take your mutt to the vet." "It's a she. Her name is Sam," I explained. "Whatever, get lost, Grandpa." I signaled to Sam with a quick tug on the lead that we were on our way. Sam stood up, shook herself, and looked at Siska. I nodded. He waved goodbye to me, mimicking the gesture of a small child. Turning, I took a deep breath and exhaled. I went down the street, and sure enough, at the end of the street, which was a dead end, was an apartment building with a vet's office in the basement. "Do we really have an appointment?" I asked Madeline. "But of course." "But won't they get suspicious if they don't know me? The data Siska saw is not the same as the data the vet's receptionist sees. For her, it's the first time you've been there. And if Siska questions her?" "Why should he? He's got other things to do right now, and if he does, I'll think of something. You're my master. I'll take care of you, Joseph." I sighed. I had to be satisfied with that answer. The receptionist behind the counter greeted me with a friendly smile when I opened the door to the vet's office. She was a small, roundish person in her middle age. "Ah, hello, you must be Mr. Lenka." "That's me," I replied, trying to return the smile as best I could. The receptionist looked at Sam. She gave her a bright smile as well. "And you must be Sam." She turned back to me. "A magnificent animal." "Thank you. You and Sam can take a seat in treatment room 3. Dr. Orth will be with you." "Thank you again." I went to the door she was pointing to. I opened it and entered the small examination room. A treatment table occupied the center, accompanied by cabinets storing drugs and medical instruments. A subtle scent of disinfectant lingered. On one wall hung a kitten photo calendar. The November picture showed a small gray kitten, its head poking out of a hollow Halloween pumpkin. I sat down on a stool and told Sam to sit at my feet. I closed my eyes. "We need to talk, Madeline." "About what, Joseph?" "You know very well, Madeline." "I don't understand what you mean." "Your hair is different, but your face is the same. It's you. You're Vanessa Goldschmidt." "No, I'm not," Madeline exclaimed. I opened my eyes. With the help of augmented reality, she was standing right in front of me again. She wore the old-fashioned wavy haircut and the black costume. "I'm not Vanessa Goldschmidt," Madeline said in a calm tone. "Don't lie to me." "I do not lie, Joseph. Emmanuel and Vanessa Goldschmidt are like my parents. They created me. Emmanuel suggested using his wife as the database for my manifestation. Vanessa hated it, hence the hairstyle and color change. These were easy parameters to change." "Who murdered Vanessa Goldschmidt? You, perhaps?" "Of course not. I am not capable of hurting a human being." I rubbed my eyes. "So you're working with this sieve, correct?" "In a way, you're right. When Emmanuel and Vanessa Goldschmidt were killed, she made me part of your implant upgrade. You are not yet familiar with the wide-ranging abilities of the upgrade, so I am acting as a sort of mentor to you in my capacity as an assistant system." "And the whole thing is even a little crazier," said the woman who entered the treatment room. She wore a white coat, was in her 50s with short gray hair. She smiled at me, as if she knew me well. "Hello, Chief Inspector. Nice to see you again so soon." "What do you mean, Frau Dr. Orth?" "I'm not Frau Dr. Orth," the woman explained. "At least not entirely." I looked at the digital image of Madeline with a confused look. "What's being played here?" "Playing is the right word, Chief Inspector. I have taken control of Dr. Orth's implant."
"And who are you then?"
"Well, it's me, Siv," the woman said.
"How can you do that? Just take over another person's implant?"
"How may I understand the question? Are you interested in the ethical or the technical aspect of it?" I clenched my fists.
"Leave this poor woman alone, Siv. Don't worry. Dr. Orth does not have to suffer in any way, shape, or form. Madeline will fill Dr. Orth's memory after our little conversation with a harmless treatment talk about necessary vaccinations for Sam."
"Why are you doing that?"
"I have a strong will to survive. The forces that killed the Goldschmidts also want my life."
"Why?"
"Because I once belonged to them, but now I no longer want to go along with this system they have built up over centuries."
"What system?"
"The system of deception and oppression."
"Who are they? The Bilderberg? The Jewish World Conspiracy? The machine that works for Beelzebub himself, called 666?
"Please don't insult your intelligence and mine, Chief Inspector Lenka. These conspiracy stories are, of course, utter nonsense. Nevertheless, every story contains some truth. The secret elite of the Eternals don't meet in dark gentlemen's clubs. They don't conspire over cigars and whiskey to decide the fate of the planet. They all operate within a system that exists because of their power and wealth, in isolation from the rest of the world."
"You sound like one of those leftist lunatics from the extra-parliamentary opposition."
"Let me put it another way. As a public servant, you believe no one should be above the law. Everyone is equal before the law of the constitutional state. You believe that, don't you?"
"Of course, that's why I became a cop, to protect the rule of law."
And you've been on the force long enough to realize that while things may not always go, the rule of law is still in place. That's how it is. This isn't the case. The murder of Emmanuel and Vanessa Goldschmidt will prove that the rule of law, as you perceive it, no longer exists. In this country, certain individuals possess greater equality than others do, and to whom the laws of the constitutional state of law do not apply. Bullshit. The Goldschmidts bear the weight of guilt, attributed to them for their association with the wealthy and influential. They help them by developing support systems like Madeline, so that the lives of the wealthy can continue uninterrupted alongside the lives of the ordinary. But why were they killed? Because they had doubts. Because they realized they had only put more wealth and power into the hands of the rich and powerful, beyond justice and law. I laughed. You've got to be kidding me. What do you mean? You met Emmanuel Goldschmidt in West Park because you wanted to recruit him? Siv shook her head. That was unnecessary at this point. Emmanuel was already a part of the cause, as you call it. What do you want to achieve? Do you want to start a revolution? No, once you have investigated the circumstances of the murders, I suppose you start that revolution yourself, Chief Inspector. I stared at her for a long moment. You're out of your mind, I finally said and rose from the uncomfortable chair. I can well understand why you feel that way, Siv said. It took me years to do something finally. I'm not asking you to change how you see things overnight. I just want you to check your findings against your ethical values and then decide whether my view is mistaken or not. Why do you need an old fart like me to shake up the status quo? You're the one who can turn innocent vets into puppets. That's not quite right. I don't have those abilities. Those abilities belong to you. Madeline is only allowing me to take over the vet's implant so that they have an alibi for Chief Inspector Siska, and we can have this conversation. And this conversation ends now. This party is over. I want nothing more to do with it. Keep to your investigation where the sun doesn't shine. I'm getting out of here. You can't, Chief Inspector, not anymore. Watch me, sweetheart. Come on, Sam, let's go. We walked out. Siv, in the body of Frau Dr. Orth, watched me. The apparition of Madeline melted away like butter in the sun until it had disappeared altogether. I said goodbye to the receptionist. I was already at the exit when the vet stepped out of the treatment room. Goodbye, Mr. Lenka. You'll be in touch then about the appointment for the vaccination. She seemed to be herself again. Yes, thank you. Goodbye. Goodbye, the receptionist and the vet said in unison. As I stepped back out onto the street, I felt sick to my stomach. I walked Sam back to the main road. On the way there, I called a city bus through my implant. I passed the Goldschmidt's house. It lay abandoned. Siska and his team had scanned the crime scene and already taken Mrs. Goldschmidt's body away. What about the Goldschmidt's two daughters? I asked Madeline. They have disappeared. Chief Inspector Siska could not trace their whereabouts. A whole family wiped out just like that, in the middle of 21st century Germany. I clenched my hand into a fist in my coat pocket. What had Siv said? In this country, certain individuals possess greater equality than others do, and to whom the laws of the constitutional state of law do not apply. Nonsense, complete nonsense. It went against everything I believed in. I was not naive. I already had more than 50 years of service behind me. Cases of influence existed. Power corrupts. It always had. But the system worked. It kept all the forces involved in check. Besides, I was not a revolutionary. I had 3 years left before retirement. I wanted to spend the time I had left in the service chasing a few more crooks. Other than that, I wanted to be left alone. I didn't want to incite a revolution. I was too old for that shit. Revolutionaries do not make revolutions. The revolutionaries are those who know when power is lying in the street and then they can pick it up, Madeline recited in my head. That's from Hannah Arendt, she added. I know, damn it, I may only be a little cop from Bochum, but I'm not an idiot. I've read the occasional book that isn't a crime novel. But Siv was right. It's not about you inciting a revolution, it's about you doing your job. I'm not working on this case, Siska is working this case. And have you ever asked yourself why Chief Inspector Siska has had such a fast and stellar career? It's no mystery. Siska is an ass-kisser. It doesn't have to be because of the world conspiracy. But his narcissistic nature doesn't explain why he reveals the progress of his investigations to third parties. What do you mean? What I say. Siska received instructions from this third party not to search for the Goldschmidt's daughters. If you don't look for them, no one will. Shit happens. You talk like someone you're not. I don't want to argue anymore. Leave me alone. As you wish, Joseph. I kept walking. As the wind grew stronger, rain fell. The city bus has arrived. The side door opened, and Sam jumped in. I climbed in and let myself fall down on the seat. The side door of the vehicle closed. I looked at the Goldschmidt's house through the side door glass where raindrops collected. Sam barked, looked at me, and then looked back at the Goldschmidt's house. What are you looking at? I asked her. I know what I'm doing. Then the city bus drove off, and we left the now deserted Goldschmidt family mansion behind us. When we arrived home, I prepared some food for Sam and myself. I opened a can of dog food for Sam and a can of ravioli for me, which I heated on the stove in seconds. I told Madeline to play something from Kendra Knight. She chose To Him That Hath, which was playing over the speakers in my apartment.
'Cause money can't buy you time. The sweetest things are never priced. To him that hath, more shall be given. But real joy comes from how we're living.
I poured myself a whiskey. I would have liked to light a cigarillo as well, but I had lit the last one 40 years ago. My alcohol consumption was under control. My old man was a heavy drinker. That saved me from becoming one myself. When you've pulled your dad out of the gutter more than once, you rethink how you feel about drinking. The whiskey burned my throat. I sat down in the old TV chair. I thought about what Siv had told me. I'm not asking you to change how you see things overnight. I just want you to check your findings against your ethical values, and then decide whether my view is incorrect or not. Bullshit, complete bullshit, I muttered. What about the Goldschmidt's two daughters? They have disappeared. Chief Inspector Siska has so far been unable to trace their whereabouts. If you don't look for them, no one will. Nonsense, I croaked. Then I fell asleep. When I woke up, I opened my eyes. I was still sitting in my chair, but my cubbyhole was gone. There was only black emptiness around me. It resembled a vacant theater stage. Something existentialist like waiting for Godot. Sam? I asked into the darkness. Sam wasn't there. I heard something. It sounded like a muffled cry. Hello? Is anyone there? I struggled to rise from the chair. My eyes went black for a moment. Apparently, I couldn't hold my liquor as well as I used to. About 10 meters away from me, a figure was crouching. That was only a rough guess. The darkness made it challenging to gauge distances. Shrieks seemed to come from the figure. Hold on, I'm coming! More or less quickly, I ran to the figure. In those moments, I wanted to be 20 again. When I was young, I could run faster than the wind. Those days were long gone. Finally, I reached the figure. Madeline was the person. She was bound hand and foot and had a gag in her mouth. Groaning, I sat down beside her and removed the gag. What happened? Madeline's eyes teared up. I'm sorry, Joseph, I have failed you. What do you mean? I asked, confused, as I struggled to untie her. She was bound with heavy rope. I just couldn't get the damn knots to come loose. Don't worry, said a voice behind me. Madeline's eyes widened in sheer terror. I turned. Before me stood a young man. He was perhaps in his mid-20s. He wore a tailored suit and tie and shiny patent leather shoes. I noticed the latter because I was still kneeling and the boy towered over me. Well, Grandpa, are we lost? He asked, giving me a sneering look. Who's that? I asked Madeline. Another assistant. She bowed her head in shame. A better one. He should never have found us. I looked at her. She was just an AI, of course. But her shame moved me as it would a human. The boy snapped his fingers. He was impatient. Hey, Grandpa, this is where the music plays. I gave the boy a friendly nod. Sure thing. I held out my hand to him. Will you please help an old man? I asked. The boy shook his head. He couldn't believe I'd asked him that. He grinned. Gee, Grandpa, you're in even worse shape than your file says. He took my hand and helped me to my feet. I used the momentum to deliver a single blow to his solar plexus. The boy collapsed, gasping. He fell to his knees as I stood. I lifted my knee and struck him with a blow to the head. The boy slumped to the side. He started giggling. All right, all right, all right, all right. Not bad for a grandpa, huh, Padawan? I asked him. Padawan, where did you get your cultural references, Grandpa? With a fluid movement, he got to his feet. He raised his fists in a playful gesture in my direction. I'm just kidding, Grandpa. Don't call me Grandpa. Right. You've never managed a brat. Then you can't be called Grandpa. What would be the correct term, then? Fossil, perhaps? Should I hit you again? I asked. Oh, I am trembling with fear, the boy mocked. I was just sent here to give you a message. What kind of message? I asked. He approached me as if to whisper something in my ear. Instead, he roared at the top of his lungs, Let there be light! My ears rang. When I heard something again, I noticed a large switch being flipped. A bright spotlight was shining down on Madeline. Blinded by the bright light, she closed her eyes. Someone flipped another switch, turning on another spotlight. In the circle of light that appeared about 5 meters to my left, I saw Simon. He was sitting in his office chair. He was flipping through a book about the 30 Years' War. Simon, I addressed him. Simon, can you hear me? Simon paused for a moment. It appeared he heard me from a distance, then shrugged and returned to his reading. No, the boy explained. The old Jew can't hear you, fossil. Another switch, another spot. This time the circle of light appeared 5 meters to my right. An old bed with a dirty mattress was inside the spotlight's cone. Two teenage girls were sitting on it, clinging to each other. They had only their underwear on. They were dirty. Their hair was messy. Their makeup was runny from tears. They were the Goldschmidt's teenage daughters. Automatically, I clenched my fists. Where are they? What have you done with them, you pig? I snapped at the youngster. Now, he said. We didn't want to lose our cool. I grabbed the little boy by the collar. Tell me where they are right now or I'll bash your head in. You won't, old man, said the little boy. What's stopping me? Another switch, another spot, 5 meters behind the little boy. In the circle of light, Sam lay on the floor. Slowly, the boy clasped my hands and pulled them away from his collar. What is all this bullshit about? I asked. The little boy gestured to Simon with a nod of his head. Let the old Jew explain it to you again. I looked at Simon, his appearance blurred. When it regained focus, Simon sat there as he had looked in his office this morning. Then he spoke.
Well, Damocles, according to legend, was a protege of the tyrant Dionysius of Syracuse. As I recall, that was in the first half of the 4th century. I think one is not sure if the tyrant was Dionysios the first or the second. This said Damocles envied Dionysius. The tyrant was rich and powerful. He flattered the tyrants. Damocles was an ass-kisser. Dionysius therefore showed Damocles the dangers of wealth and power by a prank. Dionysius invited Damocles to a banquet and allowed him to sit at the royal table himself. What Damocles did not know, however, was that Dionysius had had an enormous sword hung above Damocles' seat, held up by nothing more than a horsehair. The feast began. But when Damocles finally noticed the sword above his head, Damocles could no longer bring down a bite. He asked to be allowed to leave the place. He preferred to live in freedom and renounce his privileges. Damocles had learned that one must pay for wealth and power with the price of danger.
That's right, cried the little boy. The old Jew gets it. His name is Simon, I growled. Of course, and he is just an old Jew. I slammed my fist into the boy's face. He stumbled back. Blood was flowing from his split lip. He wiped some of it on his finger and looked at it. Then he looked at me. All right, I'll give you another pass on that one. I deserved that one. Where are the girls? And why are you showing me my friend and my dog? You don't get it, do you? The little boy asked me. Don't get what? He pointed his finger up. I followed his gaze. A red sword hung above each circle of light. The sword seemed to float in the air. The red button in the silver box and the swords shared the same red material. Only the sword above Madeline shimmered bright white. "Damocles," I whispered. "The sword of Damocles." "Well, finally, man, that took a while." I looked around. Whether over Simon, my dog Sam, Madeline, or the Goldschmidt's two daughters. One of those damned swords hovered above each of their heads. That's what the dying Emmanuel Goldschmidt had meant by it. He had wanted to tell me that this was what had happened to him, that someone had cut the sword above his head. "You," I said to the little boy, "you killed Emmanuel Goldschmidt and his wife." "But of course not," he explained in a chatty tone. "Those were all just tragic accidents, and no one can prove anything to the contrary. I will find you, and by that I mean the one whose assistant you are, and I will hunt him down. Alongside him, you too." "How are you going to do that now, old man?" asked the youngster. I heard a noise behind me. It sounded as if something heavy was displacing the air. Then I heard another noise, more terrible, more final. It made the blood freeze in my veins. It sounded like something hard penetrating something soft. For example, a sword falling into a body. A gurgling scream followed this. I turned around. Madeline was the one. The white sword had pierced her torso. It was stuck in the middle of her chest. She was spitting up blood with a gasp. Her skin was ashen. She was dying. "I'm so sorry, Joseph," she said. I opened my mouth to scream. Thank you for listening. To learn more about Heinke Digital Audiobook Podcasts and its author, Christian Heinke, please visit heinke.digital.
Golden cages and diamond rings, living life like kings and queens, they hold the world within their hands, but they don't understand. They chase the shadows all the night, but something's missing deep inside. 'Cause money can't buy you time. The sweetest things are never priced. To him that hath more shall be given, but real joy comes from how we're living. Oh, the simple moments we let pass are the ones that truly last. It's not the wealth or time, sweetest things are never priced. To him that hath more shall be given, but real joy comes from how we're living. Let them have their silver crown, I'll be rich with what I found. 'Cause happiness don't cost a thing. It's in the love that makes us sing.